Matthew Roderick will be here, and then we'll end with Dr. Walter Lowe. And then after that, Madam Chair, I do have an oral amendment just to satisfy some of our fiscal requirements.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Mr. Woodlick, please state your name for the record, and please proceed. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Rob Woodlick. I'm from Excelsior, Minnesota, and I'm 28 years old. And 2 years ago to this day, I broke my neck on a rafting trip going down the Grand Canyon. And it was a big change in my life, so I'm happy to be here today. Before this injury, I was just graduated from college as an industrial engineer, starting out my career, and then my accident happened, and for the last 2 years, I've been trying to get better in rehab and trying to get my body back, and that's my plan right now. In the first year, I think my acute costs were close to around $1 million, and due to the level of my injury, I can't feed myself. I can't do practically any daily living things for myself. I can't even drive because I can't lift my arm up. So the need for me to get better is a lot because I want more freedom and stuff. Can you hold it? So I'm going to talk a little bit about clinical trials and costs. And pre-clinical trials are usually about $250,000 a year. And then to bring that step to a in-person, it's about $2.5 million a year. So the need for state funding is important because it's kind of a developing field, and the population of spinal cord people is relatively low, so we require government assistance to get more, funds and stuff, because on a business investment, it's relatively a low population they'd be serving. And
if he asks,
right now it's still fairly early in stages, so promising of actual trials are risky for pharmaceutical company to throw money into at this point. This has been also proven a couple of years ago. There was a trial that started in Chicago injecting stem cells into people, and they had by a private company, and they had to back out because of lack of funding. So can see the need for government assistance. Currently, there have been seven clinical studies in Minnesota out of 283 nationally and 495 globally. About less than 1% of the healthcare costs associated with spinal cord injuries is spent on research. And to give you a picture of the progression of how much the spinal cord research is going, it's 15 years ago there were less than 200 studies, and now there's 495 globally. Current trials in around the world have been showing results with cellular therapy from Schwann cells that are harvested from your own body to embryonic cells, although the potential of harvesting your own cells is a lot more beneficial, because if you take another person's cell, you have to take anti-rejection drugs for transplants. So there's a transplant issue. So it's more beneficial to use your own cells rather than embryonic cells, and that's where a lot of the research is going, if you're curious about that. About 20 years ago, doctors were predicting about 15 years to never for any functional cure recovery in spinal cord injuries. Now they say about 5 to 10 years. So this is a big change in the industry shift and outlook on potential gains. I mean, I'd call it a return on investment for state or any government institution that pays healthcare costs, because I'd assume most people that are in my situation are dependent on government assistance for healthcare and daily living. And it improves quality of my life. Currently, it's important to bring trials to the U.S., and Minnesota is a good place to do that, too. It's interesting that a quarter, or if you did a clinical trial in China, it would be a quarter of the cost than in the U.S. But the downfall, it sounds great, but the downfall is that the FDA doesn't approve these clinical trials, so when a curative therapy does come, it would take years to implement in the United States, because and the only people that would be able to get treated were those that could afford to travel overseas to get treated from a foreign country. There's some good examples that probably go into this a little bit more, but of local commitment and demands for potential use of these funds. The University of Minnesota, they're transplanting, they're harvesting skin cells from your own body and then converting them to stem cells that insulate the myelin sheath that would not only be helpful to people with spinal cord injuries, but MS, ALS, and a lot of different neurodegenerative disorders and injuries. There's also a robotics lab at the University of Minnesota. The Mayo Clinic is doing nerve graft research, and I've heard interest from some of my doctors, neurosurgeons, that their local groups are interested in participating in national clinical trials that would be potentially a multi-center type study where it would have potential to be implemented here and help change the lives of a lot of people. Another number I have that's kind of interesting is there's about 1.2 million people estimated in the United States that are affected by spinal cord injuries. That's the most liberal estimate I've seen by the Christopher Reeves Foundation. But out of 1.2 million with spinal cord injuries, there's 1.7 million annually traumatic brain injuries per year. So I know that we focus a lot on the spinal cord issue, but the brain injury side of this bill has the potential to help a lot more people. And overall, I mean, it's all about getting people better, and that's the goal. I mean, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitlick, for your testimony. Thank you for being here. And I have to say that Senator Hayden, this bill has attracted a lot of attention, has created a lot of awareness, and I can talk about my own inbox has been bombarded by supporters of this bill statewide and nationwide. So I thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I see you have another testifier.
Matthew.
Please state your name for the record.
Not doctor.
I didn't know who was next.
Chair and senators. My name is Matthew Roderick. I am the father of the namesake, half of the namesake of this bill, Gabe Roderick, is with us today. Some of you may have heard me testify before to the humanitarian appeal regarding this bill. Of course, that we feel that finding a cure for paralysis from spinal cord injury is beyond value, beyond price. But we know that you have to measure dollars. And currently, with a shortfall that we all know about, we know that's a challenge. So I brought with me some information that I hope to convince you of the merit of this specific bill and for specifically Minnesota. I really want to convey that this is not a symbolic gesture for us in the TBI community and SCI community. This is based on what we believe is very real and very, very much we can see on the horizon, as Rob has started to point out to you, that a cure is imminent. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And that's becoming more and more clear as the science pushes forward. And this is not, as you may have heard in the past in some testimony that's been heard in some of these rooms, that this is not a monumental effort, a grief avoidance, or people putting their lives on hold. My son, I can do a little salesmanship. You can come see him at the Doc Martin store at the Mall of America, perform with his band on Friday night if you'd like to see that. He's certainly not put his life on hold while he's waiting for some miracle. Having said that, there's nobody in this room who wants to see a return on this public investment more than Rob and Aaron and Gabe, clearly. I'm here today because this is a worthy investment, and if I can have some visual aids for you. I put a little data together from primarily from the Minnesota Department of Health. I asked them to run some current reports on the incidence of spinal cord injury specifically. This is related to SCI. And then also from the University of Alabama, which has a spinal cord injury reporting center that's kind of used as the data nationally. If you look at this, this is an incidence of injury by level of injury. So the blue columns here represent the number of folks in Minnesota with a spinal cord injury. And from left to right, you can see C1 through C4 represents a high cervical injury like Rob has. C4. C5 through 8, which is like my son Gabe and Aaron. Paraplegic is chest down. No impairment of the upper extremities. And other refers to this sort of category of kind of difficult to determine. It could be walking quads, walking paras, still have some impairment, maybe bowel, bladder, sexual function. But not easily classifiable. This represents about approximately 10,500 people in the state of Minnesota. The red columns would represent a shift from left to right post-a curative therapy. And this was arrived at using fairly conservative estimate, a 40% success rate in a curative treatment. And though all of us want cure, we recognize that a cure is going to come in a segmental form. It's not going to have people like Rob leap out of his chair and be back to normal. What it would provide is a shift maybe from one group or a couple of levels to the next. So Rob or our friend Jenny, who is a C2-3, who's dependent upon a ventilator to breathe. She cannot breathe on her own, so 24/7 she has a machine to breathe for her. If we could move her from that C1-4 category to C5-8, like my son Gabe or Aaron, where there's some mobility in the upper extremities and the ability to breathe independently, that would be enormous, as you can imagine. And Gabe and Aaron, to be able to move them from a C5-8 more into a para category where you have increased upper extremity mobility, grasping, fingers, dexterity. And then for everybody, the potential for bowel, bladder, sexual function, which is sort of the dirty little secret of the spinal cord injury community. Most people don't like to talk about because it's embarrassing. But the fact that most everyone has impairment in that area. So if we can make a shift from left to right, we'd see enormous gains in people's lives, independence. But as the next graph would show, this is the same distribution of injury, but relative to cost. So blue columns represent the ongoing cost for treatment for each of these levels of injuries, which total, by my estimates, again, from the MDH and the UAB, $563 million a year annually just for, and again, this is, I think, relatively conservative using the Minnesota Department of Health numbers. So that shift in dollars by injury would elicit, again, with some conservative estimates, a reduction down to $437 million annually in ongoing care costs, which would lead to the next graph, which by injury shows reduction in costs. Now, you would notice, as you may have noticed in the other graphs, that, for instance, the cost for what would be considered ongoing cost of care for paraplegia would actually increase because you're moving people in higher numbers from cervical injuries into sort of a para category. So there's still ongoing costs, and that's why you see a negative number. But the total savings would be roughly about $126 million. Now, that coupled with what Dr. Lowe is going to bring up regarding the research for traumatic brain injury and projections from Dr. Roxwald of about $64 million, we're talking about $190 million, which, in our opinion, of course, we look at your $152 million shortfall for HHS and think $4 million investment is not too difficult, or even if it was over 5 years of a $20 million investment, we're still seeing a significant, significant return on investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roderick, for your testimony. Senator Hayden?
We have one more testifier. Just quickly, Madam Chair, Dr. Walter Lowe, who also will kind of give us some focus on the traumatic brain injury side of the bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record. And continue.
I'm Walter Lowe. I'm a professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Minnesota. So today, this morning, I'd like to talk about TBI, the cost of traumatic brain injury in the state of Minnesota, and how research and investment in research can actually significantly reduce the burden, the economic burden of traumatic brain injury. So in Minnesota at the present time, we have over 100,000 people in the state that have had traumatic brain injury. That's a big number, 100,000. So that's a third of the population of the city of St. Paul, over a fourth of the population of the city of Minneapolis. Huge numbers. And so we can stratify these people into three categories: those that have severe traumatic brain injury, moderate, and also mild traumatic brain injury. So those who have severe TBI are those that have lifelong disabilities. You know, they're unable to walk, have difficulty speaking, unable to recall memories or develop new memories. And I think if you see many of these people, they'll look like those that have had cerebral palsy. You know, so that level of effectiveness. For those that, at the other end of the spectrum, those that have mild traumatic brain injury, they have many of them will recover, but 20% of them will have persistent TBI. And these are they'll have problems with reading. Their eyes don't converge. They'll have sensitivity to light and sound. And so they are really the major disability that occurs here. And so if you look at the and now these people, though, also fall in this category, are those that have concussive injury, concussive, repeated concussive brain injury. So if you think about Junior Seau, linebacker for the San Diego Chargers, had repeated concussive injuries. And he committed suicide a while back and asked to have, and his family analyzed his brain. And so here, and when they looked at his brain, there was tremendous inflammation and atrophy. And he was functional. He was able to continue to play football and even after football. Even Derek Bougard played for the Wild. His brain was analyzed. Again, concussive injury, tremendous atrophy. Even I think Wally Hickelberg played for the Vikings, although he was diagnosed as, you know, ALS. But early, you know, I think what we're seeing here is that concussive mild traumatic brain injury can lead to long-term consequences, leading to depression, you know, persistent depression is very, very debilitating. So, and if you look at the, I think some of you have received this. So this is the breakdown of the 100,000 people here in the state of Minnesota. When you look at the collective cost of that, it costs annually to the state of Minnesota $1.5 billion. That's how much we pay each year to treat these people. So how could research reduce this cost? Well, last month in the Journal of Neurosurgery, Dr. Galen Roxwell, who's a former head chief of neurosurgery at Hennepin County Medical Center, reported a study that he conducted on 42 patients with severe traumatic brain injury. And so he treated these patients with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And so what this is that you put these people in these dive chambers under high pressure, and you give them increased oxygen. What that does is that it provides oxygen to an organelle in every cell in your body and every cell in your brain. It's called the mitochondria. And these mitochondria, for some reason, become dysfunctional after traumatic brain injury. They don't produce – they are the energy-producing elements for every cell in your body, for all of your brain cells. And so they become dysfunctional. But by adding more oxygen, he was able to get these mitochondria to begin producing energy again. And as a result of that, in his study, he reported that he was able to reduce the mortality or the death rate by 25% in these patients that had oxygen, hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Importantly, those that did survive also showed a significant improvement, about 30%. And so he's estimated that with hyperbaric oxygen therapy, if that could become a common treatment, so this was a small, you know, study that needs to be expanded to multi-centers throughout the state of Minnesota. But even if we take of that 10,000 in this last category of severe TBI, if we are able to treat 800 of those patients to improve their quality of life, that would save $64 million a year to the state of Minnesota. So as Mr. Roderick was telling you, with spinal cord injury, the savings that could happen there with this $64 million, that's just a small fraction of the TBI patients. That would be equal to the deficit for the reduction in the Health and Human Services for this year. But we don't know what hyperbaric oxygen therapy can do for the other categories with mild and also moderate TBI. And we think that he thinks that that could also be a benefit to these patients too. So we could make a significant dent in that $1.5 billion that's spent for TBI patients each year. And so I think that investment in research can pay back in huge dividends for TBI and spinal cord injury patients. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lloyd. Does any member have questions? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Doctor. I appreciate the information, especially the breakdown of TBI. There's a lot of new TBI research coming online. At least that's my perception, with our service members coming back with traumatic brain injury complicated by PTSD, the NHL and the NFL taking a much deeper look into concussive events and repeated concussive events. As we're having to make some choices, we see two areas, spinal cord and TBI, both presented in this bill. Maybe you could help to inform the committee where is the money flowing right now? Where's the most hope, the most promise? Or maybe we look at it the other way and say, where isn't somebody working? So that if we have limited dollars, these could be used most effectively.
Dr. Lowe?
I would say that we need to take a balanced approach. A lot of the work that's being done or that will be done with spinal cord injury can be applied to traumatic brain injury. A lot of the work that's being done with TBI can be applied to spinal cord injury. We don't know. We plant these seeds in these various therapies, and we don't know which ones will blossom. It's hard to predict, where to put your money, but we do know that, that there are things that are happening right now in both spinal cord injury and TBI. The work that Dr. Roswell is doing right now is very unique, in terms of Minnesota. He is the pioneer here in Minnesota trying to move this through, clinical trials this is something that I think is potentially a breakthrough for TBI. But he's been trying to bring this to a level where we can do multi-center clinical trials. But at the NIH, you talk about funding, by different agencies. It's very competitive now. So he's applied for grants at, the National Institutes of Health and so forth, barely missing the cutoff. And so it's another year, another 2 years, down the line. So that's another $1.5 billion that the state of Minnesota has to pay, each year for treating these patients.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. It sounds a little bit like you're targeting one particular research study in your testimony. Is that the impression that you wanted to leave with us?
No, that's just an example. There are many, many other studies that are going on. We have studies that are looking at what we call so a common phenomenon for spinal cord injury and for head trauma and even for Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease is the loss or the death of nerve cells. And so there are groups in Minnesota now that are studying what we call anti-apoptotic or anti-death promoting compounds. That could be applied not only for traumatic brain injury, but for all sorts of neurological disorders, and so that's also could be investigated for for TBI. So I don't want to leave you with the idea that, you know, hyperbaric oxygen therapy is the only thing. There are many, many potential therapeutic approaches.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I got a lot of emails about this, and sometimes a lot of emails. And I was really looking forward to hearing the testimony today to kind of tell whether, you know, which way was this going. But I just want you to know I'm just really impressed, greatly impressed. But I think this reminds me of Adam Walsh in the loss of his son, and you've seen others as well. And it's a good thing when those who've experienced something very dramatic turn their energy into helping others. And that passion that comes from the Jablonski and the Roderick family, especially with some of their unique talents and abilities to communicate and to put things together, is often what it takes. And I know that Adam Walsh probably saved many young children. We see many instances of people who have turned that grief into that passion to help others and have been so good. My first experience with the TBI situation, concussions, was with WWE, actually, and a gentleman there, Mr. Nowinski, who wrote a book, traveled the country in regards to young people in sports and their injuries, drawing attention to that. And again, personal experience turning that passion to helping others have been so helped. But I also want to really commend this particular approach, because so many times we look at the big cure and the value of taking those small steps and learning from them, and the approach of saying what's reasonable, how can we move the ball closer, learning from each of them is such a sensible, reasonable approach. It's got to be painful sometimes because you do want, your heart cries out for the big cure. But in setting this up in a way, also in regards to the financial basis, converting it to terms, in committee here yesterday, I talked about that. People talk and savings, but you've actually taken those numbers, and especially with us as a finance committee, it's especially meaningful. And you're setting up of the membership of the advisory council. I mean, these are folks who know what they are doing. Good ideas are great, but you got to translate that. And so just really looking at that, which is gaining my support, because I think this is an area that its time has come. I think if we knew the answer to the studies, we wouldn't have to do them. The whole point is, you can't be guaranteed that you're going to know just how helpful. You don't. But even if you know they aren't real helpful, you at least know that. It's the old Thomas Edison. If I knew how to get to the final one that gave me the light bulb, I'd have skipped the other 2,000 or 3,000. The point is you don't. And so in these things, but I think there is a logical thing sometimes, though, of such as I think of the prevent, which is the WWE thing of can we help to prevent immediate treatment for the kids, understanding, get them in a quiet room, be quiet, lay down. They're not weak. It's a treatment of the brain that giving the time to heal itself, rest, adding the hyperbaric to it. All those kinds of things are so important. The treatment, the immediate treatment, the 2 days, 3 days treatment. We're doing it in heart attacks, the dissolving of the clots. There are so many things that we can do, and they do translate into savings and human suffering that we go along, and then the cures. But if we work at all of them, we learn something from each one of them. But the big thing in this particular bill is that I've seen members, a lot of these things come through, but I think this one, I think, shows real merit and real value in funding and real, continuing to understand the human pain and the suffering and the prevention, all of this, I think, has certainly gained my support and enthusiasm because of the way it's structured, not just the pain and emotion that goes with it. We all feel that, but this looks well done.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Carlson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I have a bit of a frustration on a bill such as this. I do support it. This is very important to me also. I have two friends who have had traumatic brain injury. One was from an auto accident on a street in New York. She was left lying on the street for a time and then evidently was treated and is now recovered to a point where there's probably not going to be any more recovery. But in the meantime, she was a professional woman with a very, very good job, high executive, but now she is unable to hold a job. The other one was also professional in was Northwest and now Delta Airlines, and she was hit in the face with a softball in a sports incident. And she has since lost her marriage, lost her home, and if you would speak with her, with either of these women, you would say, boy, are they ever bright, articulate people, until it takes a little bit of time, and then you find out that there's a lot of repetitiveness in what they say. There's she would forget your name within a minute. She cannot use a computer because she can't even focus on a keyboard. You know, those kinds of losses, and they're not immediately obvious. And so I'm concerned about what we could do to make sure that people like your testifiers can get back into the operable, contributing part of society. And I think that this kind of research is really important. But I do have a concern. And that is, what's the best way to administer this kind of money? How much are we spending on administering the dollars as opposed to actually doing the research? Is this the best way to do it? Is that, you gave us a lot of examples from the University of Minnesota, which is our research institution right here in Minnesota. Is this the best way to administer dollars, which I would assume that you're probably going to apply for, as perhaps some others too? But is there a better way to get more money directly to the researchers who can get something done as quickly as possible?
Well, in terms of all of the ways in which we fund research, the National Institutes of Health is a major funder. But if you think, if you're familiar with the process, what happens is that you apply for a grant, and 9 months later, you know that whether it's awarded or not, and if it's not awarded, then you apply for it again, and that's another 9 months. And so that is the turnaround time is very, very slow there. There is philanthropy, so people can give to directly to a project, but that's, there are not a lot of people who will do that. There are some that will do it. And so we need to have, and there are other agencies. There are other organizations like the Paralyzed Veterans Administration and so forth. But again, there is the turnaround time and also the number of grants that they can fund is becoming fewer and fewer. The pay line right now at the NIH, 1 out of 10 grants. I mean, if you take 10 grants that are really outstanding, only one of those will get funded. As I mentioned, Dr. Roxhold's grant on the threshold of being funded, for time and time again, but not getting it over that hurdle. So that's why we think this approach. We've looked at it at a number of other states. State of Kentucky, for example, has something like this. And we are trying to model our system like theirs. They receive state funding. They've set up a council, a trust, to request grant applications. They review it. The turnaround time is 3 months there, 3 months. So that we found to be very, very effective. In fact, those people who have received state funding from Kentucky have been able to use that to generate pilot data to get larger NIH awards. So it's a way of priming the pump to bring in more research money to the state of Kentucky. So that's something that we would like to see here in Minnesota. And there are 14 other states
Dr. Long.
Can I respond briefly as well? Just to add emphasis to what Dr. Lowe just said. Kentucky is not the only state. There are a number of states, and we're pretty excited about this return on investment from the NIH. So, for instance, California, New York, New Jersey, Kentucky are examples. California, probably the most excellent example of an investment, similar, not exactly structured this way, but similar in I think, investing over a number of years, $14 million. Saw a return on investment of $84 million from NIH funding and also some private funders as well. And what we've learned from that is that when there's a small injection of state funds, which sort of greases the wheels and also makes certain labs viable, much more economically viable, then that attracts more NIH funding because it's a little more of a sure thing.
So. Thank you, Mr. Roderick. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see anything in here that says it's limited to just Minnesota research institutions. So, Senator, oh, I apologize. It was just pointed out to me. How many institutions in Minnesota would be applying for grants like this, or is it just the U of M? Senator Hayden.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, as we've gone through this, I'm not sure if I know all of them. I may look at Dr. Loda to help me with. I know the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic has done some of this work. Dr. Lowe, maybe you can help me.
Dr. Lowe?
There are many, many institutions. Duluth campus, any Minsku, campus. Anyone who has an idea about how to contribute to research on spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury. We are not limiting this to Minnesota. We are not limiting the University of Minnesota. We're not limiting this to the Mayo Clinic. It's anyone who has a good idea. And the VA.
Senator Benson, a follow-up.
Mr. Chair, actually, it's a separate question. I apologize if I'm jumping in line.
No, it's a new question. Senator Benson.
We heard a report this morning that the biggest growth in healthcare cost is going to be care for dementia. And you had mentioned that some of this research also impacts dementia. Why is that not being included in this bill? Senator.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Benson.
Mr. now, but.
Oh, excuse me.
That's all good.
I let it go. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Senator Benson, it's a little early for me, as you guys know. I don't think that we looked at excluding anything. I think that, traumatic brain injury and spinal cord research. I think a little bit of history on this bill. Matthew and Gabe live in my district. We have attended the same church, and they came to me for a fundraiser for some of the work, a gym that they were building to help Gabe and others exercise. And through that conversation and the fundraiser that they were looking to help build and convert the gym, to convert the garage into a gym, it kind of evolved into the conversation around spinal cord research. Gabe has working and does some of his work with the, Jack Jablonski, and they had a relationship with him, and that's how Jack and his family got involved. And through that and through some of the doctors, then the TBI portion of it's over the course of a year, just a small group of people that started working on this idea of if the state could contribute. So there wasn't any omission of any particular other diseases or issues or things that we could do in the state. It was just really kind of natural and organic that I met these folks and we started working on it.
Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hayden, I would agree with Senator Kiffmeyer that this is a bill whose time has come. Did I understand you to say you have an amendment that would fill in the blanks in Section 4?
I was going to get that to that as well. So,
we do. Well, thank you, Senator Brown, or Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. As is, when we originally introduced the bill, it had $4 million. Just kind of a interesting situation when it went through state government. The chair thought that it wasn't a fiscal committee, so she stripped it out for us to put back in. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment to put the bill back into the form that it was introduced, understanding that this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, and so there is a lot of conversation that needs to be had, as we all know, around our targets and our ability to put a bill together, but at least this would be a placeholder. So, Mr. Chair, on lines, Section 4, line 3.5, if we could add $4 million for fiscal 2014 and $4 million for fiscal year 2015, And then in line 3.7, if I have this right, with Mr. Albrecht, we would put after the section 144.66 dot up to 8% of the appropriation, and then change the shall to may be used by the commissioner to administer the grant.
Senator Hayden moves to replace the dot, dot, dots on line 3.5, both of them with $4 million, and on lines 3.7, replace the dollar, dot, dot, dot with up to 8% and replace the shall with may. On that motion, any questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Hayden. 8%, I did a little quick math here. That's $320,000 a year to administer the grant program. That seems to me a lot of money when you have an advisory council, but maybe there's more information to explain that.
It looks Mr. Like Albrecht here, our fiscal analyst, has an explanation. We'll see if that suffices.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, and members, there's a later bill on the agenda with the Department of Health that has a similar mechanism in it to cover administrative costs. So that's the amount of thought that went into the number, was basically we pulled the same number out of that bill, which is a much smaller overall appropriation and therefore would be a much smaller dollar amount. Mm-hmm. So that's why we added the up to, because basically the amount that it is depends on the amount of the appropriation. So yes, if this were funded at $4 million per year, it would be $320,000 a year. It's unlikely it would cost that much to administer even a $4 million per year grant. But the up to basically is an upper limit. This is certainly something that, if this language ends up in the omnibus bill, would be fixed before it shows up there to be a reasonable estimate of what the department thinks it might actually cost to administer whatever size program we end up putting in the omnibus bill.
So what I understand is this gives us the flexibility, and I see Mr. Greenman from the Department of Health, who can maybe come up and shed some light. It appears he'd like to
like that.
Say a few words, but also the manner in which that's in there, I guess I would be comfortable with at this point. I would probably, if this were to be picked up off the table and funded at $4 million, we would certainly drive that down. But given our targets, I'm not sure there's going to be $4 million per year, and so that up to eight, if that is a smaller number, then the percentage of administration costs of a smaller number can tend to grow. But Mr. Greenman, maybe you could shed some light. And
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. When we talked to Mr. Albrecht earlier about the amount of administrative costs we'd have, we didn't realize how much the grants were going to be for, and we certainly don't need 8% of $4 million.
Right.
I think we'd probably be able to administer this for about $150,000 a year at that amount.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, my approach is that it doesn't take much more effort to write a check for $1 million than it does for a dollar.
Yep.
And so when you're administering grants, the process and the effort that goes in isn't really necessarily the dollars.
So Senator Kiffmeyer, maybe since this is going to, my assumption is this will be laid on the table in just a couple of minutes because we need to
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, but this was the time to
maybe
say something.
No, honestly, but maybe the committee would trust the chair that if and when this gets picked up off the table and put into it, we will take a close look at this and make sure that it's not more than $150,000. We could change it right now if you wanted or not, but it's just on the table, and I won't let 8% of $4 million be in our omnibus bill. I can assure you of that. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And generally, guidelines for charities are administrative costs not to exceed 5%. Mm-hmm. And so 8 is quite generous. Additionally, we've been pushing on insurance companies, HMOs, to have their administrative costs lower. And now we have a department telling us they need 8. So let's look at this really closely.
So
this is not
maybe Senator Hayden would amend his
oral amendment to replace the 8% with 5%.
Mr. Chair, I would
understand that we will be making sure that there aren't excessive administrative costs built into this.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make an oral amendment to my amendment to in Section 3.7 after the Section 1.4.666. I'd like to amend the 8 to 5.
Okay. That's better. It's still more than we'd need if this were funded at $4 million per year. Senator Rosen, did you have additional comments on this?
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair. No, it was answered by you.
Okay, so on Senator Hayden's motion, I think we're all familiar with what it is now. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Hayden's oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Hayden moves Senate File 111. As amended, be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion. Any further discussion of members? Anyone else from the audience wish to speak either in opposition or in support of Senate File 111? Seeing none, on Senator Hayden's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Hayden. Chair and members.
Senator Bonoff, Senate File 153. Welcome to the committee, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I didn't expect the first bill to go so long, but it was actually an honor to sit through and to listen to that testimony and hear about the work that's being done.
Should come serve in HHS. We do this every morning.
I'm thinking about it, Mr. Chair. I was actually thinking about it. So, Mr. Chair, members, today I have before you a request for bonding proposal. And as I understand it, it's the first bonding bill that has come before your committee, correct?
That is correct,
okay.
Senator Bonner.
So I'm proud to be here accompanied with the St. David's Center folks. And St. David's is a school that is actually a block from my home. And so I drive by it every day. I have toured it many times. And I can tell you that we are so fortunate in our state to have a place like St. David's where young children with who are mainstream are served, young children with mental health issues, young children with special needs are served in a way that really honors their dignity, honors the concerns of a family, and puts them on a path towards being able to be successful in public school for the rest of their lives, in fact. So the need for St. David's service is great and growing. For example, 1 in 10 children in the United States are faced with a mental health problem, and in Minnesota, only 20% of the children who need mental health services are receiving them. We are here before you to ask for support for an expansion for St. David's, a capital expansion. St. David's is committed to raising much of the funds outside, but they are coming to us for $3.75 million of state bonds to leverage their $8.5 million of private funds to renovate and expand their center. This bill will allow for them to do the following: to expand and renovate the autism day treatment wing of the center, to expand and renovate the pediatric rehabilitative therapy facility, and to establish a mental health clinic, and to renovate the early childhood education facilities. While St. David's is in Minnetonka, it in fact serves the whole metro area and does community outreach. Their professionals travel to daycare providers. They do outreach in Wise, in homes. They truly are the metro and Hennepin County surrounding area regional center of excellence with regard to this particular treatment. And so rather than me say anything more about it, I will turn it over to Julie Shordahl, who is the executive director for St. David's, and she will share why they believe that this is so important.
Ms. Shordahl, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, senators. My name is Julie Shortall. I'm the executive director of St. David Center, and I'm here with my colleague, Dr. James Moore, who is our medical director and a developmental pediatrician who's practiced in the Twin Cities for more than 40 years. So I wonder if Dr. Moore could come to...
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee as well, Dr. Moore.
Thank you.
So I would like to present the following to you. I would like to give you a brief overview, a little bit deeper overview of St. David Center, tell you about the need in our community for the kinds of services that St. David Center provides, and tell you a little bit more about our renovation and expansion project and how this will position our organization to further serve to double our capacity to serve young children through our early intervention and treatment services. So an overview of St. David Center. We are a 50-year-old organization started in the basement of St. David's Episcopal Church, and that's where our name comes from, but very early in our history became our own 501c3, our nonprofit, a multidisciplinary, multi-service nonprofit. And we have a particular expertise in children's mental health, in autism services, in pediatric rehabilitative therapies, in foster care, developmental disability services, and early childhood education. So we have a range of services really aimed at addressing the needs of young children and their families and people with enduring special needs as they grow into adolescence and young adulthood as well. Our target population are the children we primarily serve are kids with who have mental health needs, who are on the autism spectrum, who have any range of developmental disabilities, and then this whole group of children who we are concerned about as a community that are at risk for poor developmental outcomes and school failure because of adversity in their lives. Those children that have experienced very toxic stress because of maltreatment, of living in a difficult environment. So St. David Center's services are aimed at addressing the needs of that whole range of children and addressing their needs as early as possible. Our treatment approach is a comprehensive treatment approach with a multidisciplinary set of professionals. So we have occupational therapists, speech therapists, teachers, social workers, psychologists, number of mental health practitioners and professionals who are working about serving clients about half at our center, and then about half of the clients we serve are in the community. We serve over 2,200 children annually and their families. So if you think of their family members, that can be multiply that times each family member if we're providing services in the home, for example. And we also reach the community through an intern training program. I'm sure many of you have heard of the concern about the mental health workforce and really having a concern in our community about having enough mental health clinicians to serve the number of children on the autism spectrum and with a number of needs. So St. David Center furthers our reach in the community by training 40 mental health interns annually at our center. So a little bit more about the need. As Senator Bonoff suggested, very concerned about the need of children who have mental health needs in our community. According to the Surgeon General's Office, 1 in 10 children suffers from a mental health need, yet only 20% are accessing services. And if you think of the idea of intervening as early as possible with kids who have emerging mental health needs at 3 and 4 years old, many of those children are not going to come into a clinic. And so one of our distinct strategies is to have our mental health teams go out and work in partnerships at child care centers, school districts, and in homes in the community so that we can be addressing mental health needs as early as possible, really changing the dial on that 20%. We're also concerned about the school readiness study, where we are seeing that 4 in 10 children are showing up at kindergarten without the skills and behaviors and competencies ready to succeed, and believe that a piece of that problem is around behavioral needs, and as a community need to address their behavioral needs early so that they can show up at school ready to learn. We're also concerned about the autism epidemic, the idea that one in 88 children is on the autism spectrum. And in Minnesota, according to the Minneapolis Health Department and the Minneapolis School District, approximately one in 28 Somali children in the school district have autism. So we're very concerned about that and really want to have strategies and programs ready to address those needs. So it's clear that early identification and intervention are necessary in our community, and we're positioned to address that need. That being said, we have the reason we have a bonding bill in front of you this year is that we are our organization is in a 90-year-old school building that we purchased 25 years ago from Hopkins Schools, and we lightly renovated it when we purchased it 25 years ago, did as much as we could to this 90-year-old building to have it function as an early childhood center. Since that time, we've really become, in those 25 years, have evolved into an early intervention and treatment center, and need to fully renovate this building to reflect the kind of work we're doing with children and families, such as our autism work and children's mental health clinic. And we also have plans to expand our center. We have a project that has been designed and project costs associated with it, and are ready to fully renovate and expand our building so we can double our capacity. I want to bring your attention to, I know that I see that some of you are looking at materials that we provided, and would like to bring your attention to a couple of the materials and then ask Dr. Moore to say a word. You'll see in... Okay.
Just a little bit.
Okay. It sounds good.
We're running quite behind and have a number of bills to get through.
Sounds good.
This is a really worthwhile project. I mean, I think
no
many
problem.
Of us understand.
I won't walk through the materials. I think I've talked with several of you on the committee, so you've seen the materials with me. So at this point, if I could, I'll let Dr. Moore say a word.
Absolutely. And thank you for your testimony. Dr. Moore, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm a pediatrician. I practiced in Minneapolis and surrounding suburbs since 1980. I'm proud to say that I've had a relationship with St. David's that goes back that far, 25 years. I remember when the current building was purchased and remodeled for their use, and I've watched the organization grow and thrive. My main reason for being here is to speak on behalf of my patients, their families, and all my colleagues in pediatrics and primary care in the metro area who've come to depend on this organization for services that are very hard to find. When you're confronted as a primary care provider or as a specialist with a child 2, 3, 4 years old who has needs that don't quite fit in the existing programs for early childhood mental health, family mental health, being able to turn to an excellent organization, very well run, very ethically run, like St. David's, is something that all of us have come to really value a great deal. The need is enormous. The comment that Ms. Shortall made earlier about only 20% of children in need are able to access services, that isn't just in New York City. That isn't just in Los Angeles or Atlanta. That's here in the Twin Cities as well. So I urge your serious consideration of this proposal. Many, many families will thank you, and my colleagues and I will thank you as well.
Thank you, Dr.
Mr.
Moore.
Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Yeah, and I would also say that Governor Dayton has endorsed this and has indicated that he will be putting it forward as part of his proposed bonding bill.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, we're very pleased to get that news.
That is good news, I know, for a bonding proposal.
Right.
Has Governor Dayton been out to visit the site?
Yeah,
then?
In fact, 2 years ago he actually spoke at their fundraising gala, and I was at their previous one this year, and they had over 500 people, and these families just come and just share from their heart to how much they have appreciated the service. And the
just in summary, I guess what I would say is the amount of fear a parent has when you drop a special needs child off someplace and you're not there to watch, and to have that comfort of knowing that you trust those folks. And so I'm just so grateful that they're here and doing that for our kids.
Thank you. And thank you for your continued service. Questions of members. All right. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a curiosity question on why we're hearing bonding bills and HHS finance.
Yes, Senator Brown. That's a good question. It is a little different than the path we've taken before. You know, I know we had conversation about this on the Senate floor, and, you know, I mean, this is what we decided to do as a body, was send the bonding bills out to the various finance divisions. This is largely a health and human services function. And so just process-wise, what we're intending to do here is hear the bonding bills that are related to the health and human services budget area. We will lay them on the table here till we hear all of them, and then try to prioritize and write a letter to the Capital Investments Committee about our thoughts regarding the various bonding proposals that were brought before our division. And each division will be doing that separately. And maybe we'll have a satisfaction survey at the end of this and decide whether we as a body think this is a better approach to bonding bills or not. I'm certain there are many opinions as to whether this is the right approach or not. But this is the approach that we've decided to take. And so that's what we're going forward with. And at the end of this, I would imagine we will be laying this on the table for possible inclusion in a letter to the Capital Investment Committee.
So, Mr. This is Chair, Senator Brown. So then I'll assume the Capital Investment Committee will not be hearing testimony on any of these bills?
Senator Brown, I'm not certain exactly what the Capital Investment Committee is going to do regarding additional testimony. I'm not the chair of the Capital Investment Committee. I was instructed to hear bills from the Health and Human Services side of the funding stream related to bonding. That's what we're doing. We're going to write a letter to the Capital Investment. You know, I'm not exactly sure what the Capital Investment Committee is going to do regarding hearings on these. I have some bonding proposals myself. I mean, many of us do. I don't know if they're going to need to be heard in there or not. We'll know soon.
Well, thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to note how much private fundraising has gone into this, and now they're coming to the legislature. And I just want to acknowledge and appreciate that you sought first private sector support, and then you're advocating that there is some public interest. And so that's my two cents. We're not going to have to support the debt service on our bonding projects, are we, Mr. Chair?
No, we will not be.
Thank you,
Senator Benson. We will not be carrying the cost of this. But I have been instructed by staff, I guess, corrected. Evidently, we have done this in the past at some points. I don't recall it, but it's fine. Senator Rosen, it's what we're doing, and it's what we've been instructed to do. And again, we can talk about process later. I think it's worthwhile to hear what people are doing in health and human services, capital investment proposals. I think it's a valuable conversation and welcome it here in our committee. Well, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And obviously I support this because my name is on the bill. And it is a metro project. I hope, there are services that can be received from folks out in greater Minnesota. But my question is, because it deals with early childhood education, do we have to refer this to K-12 for them to hear this? Also, I mean, the definition, of course, it has children's mental health, but do they want to hear it in the education committees for the bonding, too? That's where I'm a little fuzzy. And so when Senator Brown brought up what is the path of these bills when they have several issues and several topics they need to?
My understanding is that we've just picked one primary budget division to be heard in to send recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee, rather than trying to take each one through every single budget division. So my understanding is that with this, we would be expected to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services budget division's recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. You know, should Senator Wieger, chair of the E-12 division, wish to hear it? I mean, I suppose he could put in a request as well. But it's my understanding that I'm going to lay this on the table for our consideration of inclusion in the letter that we would send as a division to capital investments. Okay, Senator Bonoff, did you add something to add to that, or did I?
Mr. Chair, exactly, because I wondered E-12, this, and it was decided that it was most related to this jurisdiction, and so came here.
Yeah. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I've noticed on some of these is there's a fair amount of policy. And usually when you do bonding or capital investment, you don't have so much of that. And that's why these questions are arising, is because of the inclusions of some of those things versus, say, straightforward. As a member of the Capital Investment Committee that's eventually going to meet to look at these things, my concern with this process, and it was, I experienced this one other time, and I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now. And the reason why is, you know, I appreciate the expertise on the policy issues that come from this committee, but bonding bills look at things differently. And so when you don't get all of the bonding requests coming forward to the bonding committee, you don't get to see that or apply that expertise. So I think it is, I hope this will be maybe not as well followed, because I think the input from members from different committees, but that's more to policy or the specific things, but as far as to bonding. So I'm just putting my voice in, and I've experienced it twice, and it hasn't gotten better no matter who's been in charge of doing it. But I think also to be very cautious about the amount of policy, and especially policy that comes to the Capital Investment Committee. So, Mr. Chair, when you're going through your process, maybe as far as an omnibus HHS bill versus your recommendations, and I was curious, in this letter of recommendations, is that going to be in the form of it's not going to be a bill then with any actual language, just a letter?
Just the letter, Senator Kiffmeyer.
I've seen it before, but it's usually come forward as more as that. But I think if some of these policy things are seen as important, then maybe it ought to be considered, because I don't think in a capital investment bill we're going to be maybe, I don't know yet, but normally or in the past you don't do policy, you just do capital investment bonding money more strictly. So just a thought, because I see policy in these bills, not just bonding.
Okay. Any other conversation of members?
Mr. Chair, the committee
Senator
should
Bonner.
Be aware that Hennepin County is the fiscal agent, because you have to have someone.
Thank you for that clarification. Yes, you need to have the public link in order to bond, constitutional provision. And Hennepin County is the fiscal agent for this and a good partner. And it says so right in the bill.
Oh,
so any further discussion of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 153? Seeing none, we will lay over Senate File 153 for possible inclusion in the recommendation letter to the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you, Senator
Bonoff.
Thank you. Senator Wieger, Senate File 1247. And now, since Senator Bonoff went through the whole rigmarole about what our process is, hopefully it's a little bit more clear. And welcome to the committee with our second bonding proposal.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I have the two files, 1247 and 1248. I recognize the appropriation just out of the general fund dollars would be a stretch, but for the bonding proposal, we would seek funds for the Harriet Tubman Center in Maplewood. It's a regional center. The funds would be earmarked toward sex trafficking victims. It would provide beds shelter, safety, and we have a number of testifiers that will talk to the need. This is a part of a campus right by the St. Paul. It's actually a conversion of the monastery of the Benedictine Sisters, and they have opened up their, the place for a conversion into a variety of services that's being provided by the Tubman Center. So, Mr. Chair and members, I have three testifiers, and would like to start with Brad Wood, who's the chair of the board.
So, just so members, you do have two bills before us, 1247 and 1248. They're both getting at the same issue, and just for members, maybe what we'll do is just consider your testimony applicable to both bills. We will have different motions and hopefully take those both up at the end of the testimony. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Brad Wood. I am I'm the board chair for Tubman, and I'm a chief operating officer and a principal of McGough Construction. We're a commercial contractor in St. Paul. I've been a volunteer board member at Tubman for 9 years, and on behalf of the board and all of us at Tubman, I want to start by thanking the state legislature for passing the bond bill last session. In that bill, there was $2 million that was allocated for Tubman to initiate renovation of this old monastery in Maplewood, and we're very proud of the facility. In fact, you've all been invited to an open house on April 12th to see the great work that's being done there. I'd really encourage you to come if you haven't. Today, I'm here to ask for your support of Senate Files 1247 and 1248, which would provide $650,000 of funding to complete the renovation of two of the floors of the residential wing of this Tubman Center East facilities so that we could provide 36 rooms to safely house youth victims of violence in Minnesota. I believe there are many reasons, but three compelling ones I want to talk about today for why we think this funding should be made available. First, I'm a contractor, I'm a tax-paying business owner, and an advocate for victims of violence, and I really don't believe you're going to find a more cost-effective investment or better opportunity to leverage capital spending than this request. We have the extraordinary opportunity to make available 20,000 square feet, that would be two floors of this facility, to serve youth victims at a very low per square foot cost of $33. May not mean much to many of you, but when you're in the building industry, you pay attention to those things, and it's very effective use of the dollars. In our one-page handout, we've included cost comparisons, and I think you can see that because of the investment that's already been made at Harriet Tubman East, for relatively few dollars, we can inexpensively complete these remaining two floors. The second point I'd like to make is that this project really is uniquely suited to support both immediate and long-term needs. Our firm was the original contractor of this monastery building back in the 1960s. I was not part of the firm at that time, but and we've done a number of renovations at the facility since that time, so we know it well. With this funding, Tubman could rapidly, we believe, complete the required renovation on these two floors, probably an 8 to 12-week time frame, so that would mean that we could have Minnesota youth victims housed in this facility within 2 to 3 months of the time the funding is made available. Very quickly, very rapid. This is also a great long-term investment, and we know, because we were part of the construction of this facility, that it was designed and constructed in an incredibly durable fashion. The building is a poured concrete structure with a lot of concrete walls, hard surfaces for the ceilings and the floors, and any of us with families know the wear and tear that a house can suffer with active children present. I have 5 children and 10 grandchildren. I know all about that. But this facility is ideal to absorb that kind of wear and tear, and it will last for years. In Europe, you see buildings that stand for hundreds of years. This is a building that can do that. So I think an investment in this kind of facility could mean a real long-term return. The final point I'd like to make is that the facility has the capacity and flexibility to support and build partnerships. Today, the facility is a regional collaborative service center that includes other partner NGOs and offers sufficient partner space for state or county service partners to serve victims and residents or from the community on site. This is essential when it comes to assuring victim comfort, trust, and safety during the ongoing legal processes, which depend on the cooperation of a victim or a child who has been the victim of sex trafficking or exploited in other ways. Again, I'd like to thank you for the funding we've already received, but we will need your additional support in order to be able to add this shelter space to the resources for Minnesota and our children. I assure you your support will yield one of the most effective investments ever made for the state of Minnesota and for hundreds of victims of violence, especially young people. I want to thank Senator Wieger for his leadership, and I want to thank you for your time today, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions, or we could hear testimony from the other two.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Who cares to go next? No.
I'll go next.
Please state your name for the
morning,
record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Janelle Presley, and I am the director of the residential services at Tubman and have served nearly over 20 years. As you see in your handout, our shelters have served over 25% of the shelter families and individuals that have experienced violence. We are person-centered, and so Tubman has sheltered and supported not only victims and families of domestic violence, but elder victims, parents of all ages, and yes, including minors and children. Tubman has been in partnership and pride since 1991. We provide after-hour and weekend crisis services for their phone support, and Tubman and Pride do co-advocacy with women that come to our shelter. Advocates at Pride have very great expertise and experience, so we really rely on their support. Tubman has expanded our services, and I want to just tell you a little bit about it. We've added trauma-informed practices for children and adolescents, both in child care and with various clinical therapies, in addition to our new safe space. Through partnerships with other NGOs and colleges, we believe our staff is excellent and highly qualified. Finally, the laws are changing, and we thank you all for all the support you have given us with that. Others now know that victims, women and children and victims, need to be, number one, understood as victims and served as such. Number two, serve safely. Whenever they face their fear, we are there to help support them. And number three, encouraged to come off the streets and highways and to trust and come to safety with our organization. And lastly, number four, supported as children on the long road to a changing life along with their own children when they have them. Lastly, I'd like to add, our long-term relationships with law enforcement and judicial systems. We welcome new partnerships that will be established in Minnesota in our new approach and practice amongst the best in the nation. I'm sorry. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I would like to be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Presley. I think maybe we'll finish with testimony and then ask for questions. Wow. Ms. Stark, is that correct? Are you
correct.
Welcome to the committee?
Greetings, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and senators. My name is Tamara Stark, and I am the director for youth services at Tubman. We serve young people through many different ways. I lead our violence prevention work in 40 to 50 middle and high schools in the Twin Cities each year. The youth specialists and youth advocates in our residential programs are also a part of my team. Both Ms. Presley and I manage federal partnership grants with other Minnesota NGOs. Ms. Presley has one regarding those with brain injury or unseen disabilities, and I lead one that provides comprehensive trauma-informed services to homeless youth who have been victimized. Because both of these multi-year projects impact the discussion at hand, I offer them to you as you consider the necessity of providing accessible, safe, and shelter space by approving funding to complete the final two floors at Tubman East. This past winter, the families were thrilled to move into the two first floors and just love the resource for a few key reasons. It's safe. Each bedroom is quiet and allows for individual healing. We have spaces like classrooms, computer labs, meditation rooms, teen center, group rooms, even Harriet's clothing closet and an art room, all leading to change, learning, and healing in a supportive and non-judgmental atmosphere respecting diversity. It's accessible as well to our other NGO partners because they can have their own spaces to serve alongside us. In partnership with the Link, we also know how desperately our young people in Minnesota need safe shelter, a place where they can feel safe long enough to focus on their goals and a brighter future. given just how safe, solid, and sound Tubman East is, I'm sure you can see how it's such an excellent resource to our work addressing not only family violence, but also those escaping from being trafficked, neglected, and sexually exploited. We hope you will approve enough funding to show us to allow us to do this renovation simultaneously with what has already started, and your decision can impact hundreds quickly and a very reasonable cost to Minnesota. Thank you so much for hearing us today, and we look forward to your questions.
Ms. Stark, thank you very much. And I hope Tubman knows that you have a phenomenal advocate in Senator Wieger. I recall last year the motion on the Senate floor that was successful to get some of this initially started. And he's been a tremendous advocate. Any questions of members?
Senator Mr. Wieger. Chair, I'd just like to thank the committee for all of its hard work, and I know you've got a lot of big issues to address, and you're also very aware that we're addressing people in crisis.
Yes.
They've devoted their careers to that. It's a very successful track record, and it's providing hope for people in their darkest hour of need. And as the chair of McGough, Brad Wood, the chair of the board now, points out, this is $32 a square foot. And with the partnership with the monastery, it's a win-win situation. So it's cost-effective, the needs there. There are several people here. I won't introduce everyone, but I would like to acknowledge the past chair of the board, Judge Eric Lippman, who's here as well.
Great. Thank you, Senator Wieger. I'm seeing no further questions of members. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this? Okay. With that, we will move that the bond issue, Senate File 1247, we will just lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the recommendation letter to the Capital Investment Committee. And Senate File 1248, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 1248 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
That, we will be moving back to Senate File 1034, the governor's budget bill. We're going to be covering MDH portions of the governor's budget bill today, and I'll come up to the table and... I recognize the signs of somebody nervous up here. There's a broken paper clip.
Senator Lori, whenever you're ready.
Okay. So Senate File 1034, and what we're going to be doing today is the Minnesota Department of Health budget items. We've got Dave Greenman, the budget director, to kind of lead us through these sections. And I'll just run through them for you. They're on the handouts, but it's the healthcare facility blueprint review, the healthcare licensing reform, the groundwater protection from geothermal, the cost recovery lab testing, the modification of environmental lab assessments, the modification of mortuary science regulation, the newborn screening proposals, and the SHIP proposals. And it's a lot of ground to cover, but we've got some good handouts, and hopefully we'll be able to accomplish this. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dave Greenman from the Department of Health.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll briefly go over, first of all, thank you for having us here today. My name for the record is Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director with the Department of Health. And I will quickly go over some of the handouts that we have for you. First of all, there is sort of a two-page PowerPoint that briefly goes over sort of a high-level review of our budget, sort of the philosophy behind what the the budget we're setting. Then there's also a fact sheet that's basically our budget change items. This includes all the items in our budget, not just those that we're going to be covering today. And then there's also a document that's essentially a crosswalk between where items provisions show up in the fact sheets and where they show up in the budget bill. And this is based off of the unofficial engrossment for the bill. Let's see. So first of all, I think I'd like to...
Is everyone tracking that? I know keeping people oriented is difficult but important. Everybody kind of on the same page with how to find the materials as we go through this? Okay, go ahead.
First of all, I'll start briefly going through this PowerPoint, the PowerPoint pages. There's a table on the first page that provides sort of a high-level overview of the department's budget. Just as background, I know we've presented these items before, many of these items before, and we've talked to you before about our base budget, so I'll go through this quickly. The total base budget for the department for fiscal years 14 and 15 is about $1 billion, and that's all funds, including state and federal. The general fund base is about $150 million for the biennium, so that's about $75 million a year. The total spending change in our budget package is $59 million. Those pieces include $40 million for the statewide health improvement program, or SHIP, which is that comes from the Healthcare Access Fund. About $9.5 million in new spending for our regulatory and screening activities. These are activities that are funded through fee-based programs, and they are paid for through the state government special revenue fund. We also have $7.7 million in clean water activities that are paid for through the Clean Water Fund. That's not before this committee, so we won't be covering that today. And then the last two items, one is an increase in funding of $2 million for core public health activities and a reduction in rent. Those are both general fund items. So the total net impact on the general fund of this budget is $1.8 million over the biennium. We also have $9.4 million in revenue changes, and these, again, are through our fee programs. So the total net impact of our budget request, including the Clean Water Funds, is about $49.6 million. On the next page, we sort of looked at what our objectives were, what our sort of philosophy was behind the proposals that we put forward or the governor put forward. First, it focuses on investing and expanding, maintaining evidence-based programs that have been proven to be successful and that affect some of their most pressing public health concerns in the state, and that primarily that includes the SHIP program. And also, the focus is on maintaining core public health services, particularly in light of the cuts in federal funding that we've had to try to find a way to absorb and in some ways avoid making reductions in some of these fundamental services. And then thirdly, to maintain existing regulatory and screening activities to make sure that we meet our statutory requirement to balance the cost of the services and the revenues that we were able to bring in to cover those costs. So we'll start, I think, with the first article. First item is Article 12 of the bill. And I think for this particular item, what I'd like to do is ask. I have a lot of smart people from the Department of Health behind me in case I wander off course too far. What I'd like to do, though, is not even rather than attempt to discuss the home care proposal, because it's actually all of Article 12 and includes a number of sections, I'd like to ask Susan Winkleman, who's our Assistant Division Director for the Compliance Monitoring Division, to briefly go through those provisions.
Thank you, Ms. Welcome. Can you state your name for the record?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in Division of Compliance Monitoring in the Health Department. Let me, in the interest of time, go through the highlights of Article 12, which is our home health care provider licensing restructure, and other items are included. This is the origin of this proposal comes via a process with the stakeholder group that included providers and consumers and also some other state agencies who were involved several years ago, based on a legislative directive in 2007 to look at what, if anything, should be done with our current home care regulation well, regulations. And what we decided right away was that we had a very unwieldy licensing system with four different license types, and so we set about to streamline that four license types into two. And so we have, the proposal contains information about a basic license and a comprehensive license, which makes it more simple for providers. We were also at the same time reorganizing internally to look and dedicate more staff energy to what exactly were the problems out there. And we were identifying some increasing health and safety issues out there. We also recognize that we are woefully understaffed. We have four inspectors for over 1,500 providers. We are very unable to get out there to all of the provider sites and do on-site inspections very often. And so this proposal addresses that as well. Specifically, the parts of the proposal are that it increases fees and to support staffing levels so that we can get out to every provider at least once every 3 years. It establishes a new temporary license system along with the new basic and comprehensive so that you get a temporary license first, and then we go out within the first year and make sure that you're in substantial compliance before we issue the regular license. Yes. So we're increasing consumer protection in that way. We've increased the entry requirements a bit so that the license application requires you to have thought about how you are going to conduct this business and that you're ready to practice. And we have also made some changes to medications management and some updates and clarification. We're moving all the rules, the various rules that were in different places, all into the statute so that it's in one place and it's easier to read and for providers and consumers alike. We have also established a transition period to get us from the old law to the new law. And then also we have are proposing an advisory council, which is a new addition for this industry, so that it's a Department of Health advisory council that has licensee members on it, as well as consumer members. So when we're talking about emerging issues and problems in the field, we have the right people in the room at the same time. Finally, I wanted to point out to you in the last section of our article, we have something called integrated licensing, and it's a project that we undertook with DHS licensing that because they are also undertaking a new license for home and community-based services, which sounds identical to home care services, but it actually is not. But we, as a group between the two agencies, got together in November and December and decided to figure out what are the conflicts, if any, and what should we do about it. What we discovered between the two proposals, the home care licensing proposal and through the Department of Health, and we've been licensing these folks since 1987, what we discovered is that our proposal and the DHS home and community-based services licensing services are not the same at all. However, we did realize that there are about 140 providers who are currently licensed as home care providers who would, if we did nothing, be required to also obtain a home and community-based service license from DHS. So what we are proposing in the integrated license is to say that for those providers who already have a license through the health department, we're going to figure out a way to integrate the license between home care and home and community-based services so that by next session, we'll bring back some proposals to fix it so that they only have to go through one license or one agency to get one license, have one fee, and we'll figure out how to mesh the requirements as best we can. So that was our commitment, kind of developing somewhat of a new model, but making use of our expertises across the agencies and perhaps coming up with additional opportunities. So that's what I can tell you in a very brief, short period of time. Any questions?
I do have a question, Ms. Winkleman, regarding you mentioned the advisory council and having Department of Health and consumer members. Can you elaborate what consumer members you're establishing there and how many?
Yes. Let me get my cheat sheet for this. It's
it's an 8-member council, and we have specified that it be 3 public members, and so they either need to be clients or family member of clients. And I think that there's a time period, maybe about 3 years, within 3 years, so they don't have to be current. And then 3 licensees that would represent both of the new types of license, basic and comprehensive. We have to have at least one of each. And then we're having 1 board of nursing member. We run into all sorts of nurse practice issues, and we want someone right there. We have a slot for an ombudsman for long-term care member as well. And the advisory council is under Chapter 15, so there would be appointments, and there would be staggered terms for the members, and there would be at least to meet quarterly. And then the charges for the advisory council are just to discuss emerging trends, practice issues. I think I've seen this process in action several times, and it's kind of a neat process, because when you have enough public members, they're hard to find, but when you have them in the room, it's a completely different conversation.
Madam Chair, if members are interested in finding that makeup of the council, it's on Article 12, Section 25, beginning on page 437 of the big bill, and that's where you'll find it, the actual language.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question in regard to the fee structure here, which is changing, and there's some fairly substantial increases. And there's a concern that I've had over the last 10 years, actually, of seeing a lot of the funding being shifted more and more onto fees and fines also, which are substantially increased in this. And so I do have some concerns about that, especially the degree to which they're increasing. And I was wondering if you could explain to me, you know, what the fee increases are really based on. I've seen examples where they could be jumping like 800% in some cases here. And it seems to me that's really placing a significant burden and doing it so quickly like that. At the very least, it seems to me that the fee increases to that degree should be phased in over time to give the home care providers the opportunity to adjust to these changes. But so if you could just explain a little more what the fee increases are based on, what's going to be done with the revenue that's generated from these fees, and also likewise with the fines, if you could also address that side of it, because the fine structure went from a range of $50 to $500 to $500 to $10,000, and when those fines will kick in, what constitutes a $10,000 fine, what will constitute $500, and so on, and again, what the money would go to for those. And I know you already mentioned that there's going to be more inspectors or surveyors, that's part of what it goes to, but if you could elaborate, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Ms. Winkleman?
Madam Chair, Senator Eakin, I think you've asked a 2-part question, a really good one. I don't know in what order we can go, if you want to talk about the phased in part first.
Sure.
Or
Mr. Greenman?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Eakin, I think the fees are essentially set at levels that we currently need to look at what the cost is going to be of administering this program based on what we think we need to do to adequately regulate these providers. And as Ms. Wickerman pointed out, there's right now we are, as she said, woefully understaffed. The fees, I don't believe, have been increased in somewhere around 20 years. So or at least some of them haven't been. And so I think that's one reason why you're seeing such a large increase all at once, is because we're trying to make a pretty radical adjustment to the way that we license home care providers in the state, or that we regulate them in the state. We did, as she said, we have been working with the home care industry and have been talking about, obviously that is the amount of the fee increases is a concern. One of the things I would say is that phasing the fee increases in is an option, but by law we have to balance the cost of operating these programs with the revenue that we're able to bring in. So if we are going to phase in the fees, we need to look at what we need to be doing then to phase in the regulatory changes. And I think that's something we would need to look at. We didn't feel like we could wait any longer to start making these changes, though. The fact that some of these providers are licensed and get licenses and then aren't inspected for up to 3 years is pretty concerning to us. We feel like we need to have more people out there quickly doing a lot of this work. We feel like we need to make sure these folks are getting licensed in the first year that they're operating, and also that we have staff to make periodic changes or to license them periodically. To make sure we have staff in the building periodically to make sure people are being well cared for.
Senator Egan.
Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. I still have concerns, however, what this is going to do for some of especially the smaller home care providers that may not be able to absorb some of these high costs. And so I just wanted to express my concern about that, and I don't know if, you know, what would if you have information about what the average increase is going to be for the providers, and if that can be broken down to the smaller or larger providers, what the average increase would be?
Madam Chair, Senator Egan, we can certainly get that for you. One of the issues is that we have four different licensing categories now, and so we have four different fee structures, which makes for a very complicated system. And what we're essentially doing is we're combining everything into one set of fee systems. And so we have, if you look, the fee increases for the smallest providers are actually still fairly low, $166 for the smallest type of provider that has no more than $25,000 in revenue in a year. That's still a significant amount, but we certainly have tried to keep the fees down as much as possible for the smaller providers.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Greenman, as far as the fines are concerned, moving up to possibly $10,000 fines, I was just wondering what would constitute, for instance, a $10,000 fine. And
Ms. Bookelman?
Madam Chair, Senator Egan, the fining system, right now we have all sorts of fines that are very, very little. They're $50, $100, $150, things like that. The fining system that we're proposing in this language is tiered. It's a two-tiered system trying to respond to some of the providers' suggestions about being kind of more flexible, but we did increase the fines. I mean, and the one thing that we didn't change is that no one is fined on the first visit. We write down the correction orders and the violations, and then if they don't comply the next time we come through, then there's a fine, and then there is a full appeal right on that fine to go through a contested case. So there's a balance there. But we're finding with the fines being so low, it's not the most effective device for a remedy or to get someone's attention so that there isn't a recurring violation into the future. The really high fines are only assigned for the most egregious situations, and I'm not convinced that we would necessarily even have fines at that level if someone is abusing someone or engaging in any sort of maltreatment. We probably would be looking at a suspension or a revocation and not a fine, but the fine is an option, and that's at the highest category of wrongdoing.
Senator Benson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Huge change going on here. And we talked a little bit about, you mentioned that fines wouldn't apply under the first incidents in most cases. Is there going to be some sort of assistance for smaller providers so that they can get appropriate training and it sounds kind of like on-the-job training. If somebody comes in and gives you an order of correction, is there a step that you're going to do before that to phase in some of this work, especially for small and mid-sized providers who don't have capacity to do this?
Ms. Winkleman, excuse me.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. Yes, an important part of any regulatory program is the information up front. I mean, the whole point of regulation and the whole goal is to prevent violations in the first place.
So we have information online in our website now, but part of the fee revenue or part of the budget is to also hire somebody who's knowledgeable in website development and a little IT so that we can get much better information and easier to access for providers. So we're committed to trying to look for ways to prevent violations. That would be an essential part of any regulatory program.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, thank you. Looking at October 1st of this year that you're going to start inspections.
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson.
Or licensing.
The transition period is ambitious, and let me sort of go through what the schedule would be. So it would be October 1 would be the first date that new licensees would need to come under the new laws. And so, yes, from the time that this might be enacted to October 1, we would be very busily getting up to speed and getting our forms redone. I mean, we have an existing licensing program now, so it's not like we're going from scratch. So we would be making changes to existing forms. So the new people coming in, they start October 1, and then the current people who are already licensed would start renewing at their regular intervals of renewal time over the next year. And so within a year from October 1, everyone would be under the new system. One of the tricky parts about restructuring of this magnitude is the transition period. You need it to be long enough so that people can get adjusted, but short enough so that the pain is shorter. Because what you're doing during transition period is you have two sets of laws applying to various providers, and it can get very confusing. So we tried to make it fair so that people could get going, but that it was a limited period of time so we could get everyone to the other side in a kind of a reasonable time frame. So that was the idea.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, thank you. How much engagement have the providers had on the changing of the forms? We regulate people to death, and paperwork piles up. How much input do they get on the forms, on the transition time? Have you heard from them? They're the ones who are suffering the pain under the two laws. What do they think of the October 1st date?
Well, Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we're aware that the providers, there's three provider organizations that represent home care providers, and they've joined together, which is great, and they have suggested some longer transition times, and we've met with them last week, and we're working on what options might exist. So that's very much in conversation right now for transition times and other matters that they've brought to our attention.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Winkleman, if you could address the form development.
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the form development, I'm not sure that we've devised our work plan yet to kind of get that going, but we'll make every effort to have the provider groups help us and give us input, but I'm not sure exactly how we've formulated that yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Winkleman, I just think that the people who are going to be using forms and living with them every day should have significant input as to how much detail and complexity, particularly if they're already reporting for some other purpose in another place, get some synergies there. I would ask you to please consider a phase-in of the fines. Rate shock is pretty serious in this case. And if somebody's already kind of on the margins, they might just say, you know what, I'm not going to bother with more regulation. I'm not going to bother. We don't want to lose providers or have some other adverse consequence.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Benson did mention one of the questions I was very concerned about is how much the industry was involved in this, because, and I'm sure Senator Eakin, many of us around this table have facilities, home care providers of all sorts that are just barely making it, you know, quit providing health insurance and live in the red every single month, and it's a big concern. My question was about the appeals process. How does that happen right now? Are there going to be changes to the appeal process?
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there's a couple of different appeals. Right now there's appeals for fines and any sort of enforcement action like revocation or suspension, and that is under Chapter 14, and that goes through the full contested case hearing process. Regarding correction orders that we currently issue, there's no formal appeals process in current law for that. In our proposal, we are proposing a reconsideration process so that there would be some form of review internally by staff to make sure that what our correction orders say and what happened out there match. And so there's some, and that was in direct response to some of the providers' concerns about reviewing the correction order process. But right now, we don't have a formal reconsideration of it, but we do have a supervisor who receives about 5 calls in the last year, she's reported, of people who have said, I don't think you got this right. And in one circumstance, she did make the change that they had identified that something was wrong in the correction order.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it easier just to pay the fine than go through the appeals process? Is it cost money to go through the appeals process, too, for these facilities?
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it would cost money for people to undertake a Chapter 14 contested case hearing. It's our experience that folks do appeal and do proceed. Of course, the contested case proceeding in Chapter 14 is not supposed to be like a big trial in district court, but as we all know, things can get really formal quickly. But we do see our appeals. They're usually in concert with sanctions that we're trying to proceed with that are related to a suspension or something more serious, and then they'll appeal the fine as well.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, as far as the fine, when are we going to see, or will we be able to see the breakdown of what constitutes a $500 fine or a $10,000 fine and the difference between there? That's my first question. My second question is they obviously have to hire their own representation for the appeals process, I would assume. Is that correct? And if you have people that are being trained and supposed to be ready within 6 months, I'm very concerned that this could get out of hand. And all of a sudden, it's easier to just go ahead and pay the fine, or do you go ahead and hire somebody to represent you and fight the...
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we are in conversations with the 3 home care organizations and about fines and about transition period. And I think even we're still in discussion about what the compromises might be, but we're willing to look at the transition times and the fines. That's part of our discussion.
Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, did you mention how many FTEs? Or how many new surveyors? I did not see that, so I'm
Senator
sorry.
Rosen, I believe it's on page 2. It looks like it's 15 full-time equivalents.
Is it 16? Did you say?
Is it 16?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I don't recall specifically the breakdown of each type of staff, but let me give you the overview picture. Right now, we are able to support with our budget 9.25 FTEs. That includes 4 inspectors, 2 license application reviewers, 1 supervisor, and 1 investigator, and then a smattering of management and policy staff in there. The proposal raises fees sufficient to support 31 staff. So this is tripling what we can do. And we've estimated that we will be able to meet the goal of getting out there once every 3 years. Right now, I don't like to talk about how long it takes us before we get out to see providers, but I think it's
once every 8 years. That's kind of what we're able to do. That's not good enough for what we're dealing with out there and what we're uncovering. So this, we do see this as a needed increase. It is a big increase for providers. We're concerned about that as well. But we're trying to balance that with the needs of the field and our inability to really oversee them properly now. So, oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Ms. Winkleman, my question is, you know, ideally in a perfect world, we'd be there yearly, annually, a more recurrent time. But realistically, and knowing the budget targets that we have to meet, I know Senator Lori has a big challenge ahead. And taking into account businesses that also get randomly checked by different agencies, ideally you would be there every year. And I get what you're saying in terms of the population you're serving. You want to make sure that providers are doing their job, but you also have to prioritize as well that, you know, when you have an incident, when those get reported, those get priority in terms of getting those visits. So where do you strike a balance? Because we're never going to have enough resources to provide you the FTs you need to be in full force. So is this a giant leap into something that's ideal but maybe not realistic under this climate, and where, how can we scale it? And I do have concerns about the fees. I do have concerns about the penalties that we're trying to do too much in 3 years versus five versus 10. And given the budget constraints, it just seems like we're moving. The proposal is very aggressive. And my concerns is that there might be unintended consequences for providers, and I haven't heard from them, so maybe there are some here that want to testify. Senator Lori?
Madam Chair, that is a point I was going to make, is that I do believe that there are several providers who have asked that they be able to provide testimony. It might provide some clarity as to the level of conversation that's been going on so far. That's always what I want to know. And, you know, do they feel comfortable with the stakeholder process that's going to go on before now? I mean, we're not this, you know, this bill, I think it's been demonstrated well. There's enough concern that this probably isn't where we're going to wind up at the end of the day. And so if we could maybe hear from some of them. And then just for time management, I mean, we do have session at 11. We're not going to make it through this Department of Health provision this morning. That's obvious. And when we get done with this conversation, and these are really important conversations, so I don't mean to try to hustle them faster than people are comfortable with, but just for members' awareness, I think we're going to move after this to the SHIP, because there's people that have come from out of town to try to testify this morning on SHIP, and then the balance of MDH will probably have to wait till this evening's hearing. But maybe we could break and do hear from some of the providers that wish to testify on this provision.
I believe Senator Benson has a
Madam
question.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, just one quick point for Ms. Winkleman. In the audit field, you don't audit everything all the time. You do risk assessment. And so given limited resources, do you take a risk-based approach to decide who needs to be visited annually now?
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, right now, because of our kind of, we're so overburdened, we do have a set list that we try to get to every year. But what happens is we run into an emergency and it becomes all hands on deck. So in that way, that's how our priorities are being led now. We're out on site, we're seeing a crisis, we're encountering something so serious. So at this point, because we're not able to get out to even see who is out there in total, we aren't as good as prioritizing because we haven't even been to everyone yet. So our priorities are kind of right now by emergency as we're uncovering them.
Senator Sharon?
Well, I support Senator Lori's request that the people come up that want to testify on this. And while they're doing that, for time's sake, I just want to make a comment. I think what we're really focusing on now is to make certain that the process of change takes into account the needs of the providers. But I think we need to continue to have that conversation. You know, how is the survey, how are the surveyors trained? Are they able to establish some schedule that allows them to check certain things over time? All those are really important questions. But they're really coming from the perspective of making certain that the system that provides the service are not overburdened by that in the process of change. But I also want to remind everybody that we are way underfunding a system that needs to go out and take a visit every now and then to these facilities that are serving our most vulnerable people. And if we had a crisis in one of these facilities and then it came back that the department had not been able to be there for the last 5-6 years, what we'd be saying to these people today? So in the process of running them through the coals over their proposal here, I'm hoping you remember that we are asking them, we ask them to put together a process that would strengthen what we need to do in these facilities to protect vulnerable people. That's their job. And if we aren't funding them to do that, then we're going to have bad things happening. Not that all the people who are here testifying are bad players, working very hard with very little resources. But the department has a responsibility to make certain that the people that are served in these facilities are served safely, and that when we leave our family members there, that they are served in ways that at least the care doesn't create further problems, and certainly that there's not abusive treatment occurring. So I just want us to get back into the context of understanding that we've asked for this, we need this, we have vulnerable people that we're serving, we ought to support them in being able to fund what they need to do to make sure those people are safe. But at the same time, I believe that they're engaged and very interested in listening to how to make the transition reasonable on the providers, but remembering that we also have to ask the providers to cooperate with the process that we need to have in place to protect vulnerable people.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. With that, I will ask some of the other testifiers from the provider community, Mr. Doug Beardsley with Care Providers of Minnesota, and from Aging Services of Minnesota, I believe we have a few people as well. They would step forward so we can hear your testimony, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Beardsley, and I'm the Vice President of Member Services at Care Providers of Minnesota. And with me today is Christian Knights, who's the Director of Government Affairs with Aging Services of Minnesota. We're also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Home Care Association. Between our three organizations, we represent the majority of home care providers that provide services in the state of Minnesota, and they will be affected by some of these sweeping changes proposed in the bill. Our association, as well as many other organizations, have worked with the Minnesota Department of Health on the rewriting of home care rules since 2007. Our goals have been to create cleaner and more understandable regulatory language for providers of home care services, minimize confusion between home care licenses for consumers, increase the frequency of surveys conducted by the Minnesota Department of Health, and create a reformed survey process, all while maintaining cost-effective home care systems for Minnesotans. We've been very pleased with the dialogue and debates that have occurred between our organizations and the Minnesota Department of Health, and we feel that this bill achieves many of the goals that we have set forward. We thank the staff at the Minnesota Department of Health for creating the process and listening to many of our concerns and opinions. We do, however, continue to have significant issues with just certain parts of this bill. These issues have been discussed numerous times with the Department of Health, but to date we have been unable to arrive at any acceptable outcomes. We remain hopeful and committed to resolving these issues and finding a bill that works for us all. Specifically, we find ourselves unable to support the bill in the current form until the following five issues are addressed, and Kristen will speak to some of these.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to address a couple of issues, and then Doug will
continue. Can you please introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. Certainly. My name is Christian Knights, and I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota. The first issue that I'm going to address is the annual home care licensing renewal fee that some of you asked questions about today. We agree that the home care licensing fee structure needs to be revised in order to support the goal of a study every 3 years. However, the licensing fee proposed in this bill is so substantial that our home care agencies really feel we need a 2-year phase-in of licensing renewals. For example, right now, a provider that is an F, a class F, or what will be a comprehensive license, is paying $781 for that renewal fee. That renewal fee will go up to $6,500. I think that was sent to Econ had referenced the 800%. So that's kind of just one small snapshot of some of the increases. What we'd be looking at would be part of this 2-year phase-in would be the first 2 years, the proposed fee would be limited to the lesser of 200% fee increases or $1,000 higher than the previous year's fee.
except in cases where that 200% or $1,000 increase exceeds the actual renewal fee. So we would get to these levels that have been proposed, but it would be as part of a phase-in. This transition would allow home care associations to modify their business plan, alter their budgets, and determine how much the fee increase can be passed on to the consumer. As a side note, we're still a little unclear, although some of it has been cleared up today by the testimony, about how the fees were exactly calculated. I think our understanding is it's for the new staffing, but we're still somewhat unsure of where the figures kind of were got from. The second item I'll touch upon is the transition time frame. And I think this really is something that caveats with a lot of the other issues that Doug will talk about too. The current language has the timeline to transition unrealistically fast pace. We really feel that providers need at least 12 months to understand the new regulations, update and implement current policies and procedures in an organized and systematic manner, modify their budgets, and train their staff. Currently presented, this bill requires all of the successful completing by October 1st of 2013, which is just a four-month time run. I think this is something that, you know, we feel very strongly on, and we've been talking to the department on, and we're hopeful that we can find an acceptable solution.
Thank you, Mr. Knights. Mr. Bridgesley?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The other three issues we'd like to speak on, I can go through. The first is the fines. I think there have been some questions raised on the fines. Okay. We frankly support increase in both the fees and the fines because we think it will achieve some mutual goals. However, we're unclear about the jump from a maximum of 500 to a maximum of 10,000. That's a pretty substantial increase in the maximum fines. And we're also unclear about when that spread will be applied to what types of findings. There really is no limitation right now or clear limitation on the bill when you would receive a $2,000 fine and when you would receive a $4,000 fine and when you would receive a $10,000 fine. We certainly think the fines should be clearer delineated to the type of finding so people know what to expect if they have a determination. The fourth issue that we're concerned about, and this is a really serious issue for our members, is survey process reform. I believe we really come to the table saying we're interested in being surveyed more often. We're willing to pay for that survey more often, although we don't think we can take it all in one lump sum in a one-year period. We'd like a three-year phase-in. But we also, along with that, would like a more clearly defined survey process. For example, right now, as I think the health department said, we're being surveyed on average of every 8 years, and some people have never been surveyed since they've been opened. We know that's a problem. We want it solved. However, if we're going to be surveyed more often, we want it to be a fair and understandable survey process. The current issues we see have problems with are the lack of an informal dispute resolution process, which I think was asked about today. Right now, the only resolution is to go to a fair hearing or call the supervisor and have an informal debate. And that's not a very, when you look at fines of $10,000, that's not a very structured process. Frankly, we've asked for a process that has worked well for the nursing home field, which is that you have two processes available. One is an informal dispute resolution process, which is an internal process done by the Department of Health by someone not involved in the deficiency, and one is an external decision process. So it goes to an administrative hearing, law judge, or someone else that wasn't involved at all in the original finding. We believe follow-up visits, for example, right now they're occurring at least 6 months many times, sometimes a year after the initial decision was made. That's too long for a provider to wait to find out if they've made the right correction. It's too long to find out if they haven't made the right correction and unsafe practices continued for a period of time. When a surveyor leaves a building right now after survey, the provider has no idea when they're going to get the survey findings. It can be 3 months later. It can be 4 months later. It can be 3 weeks later. Again, there's no standardized process in place for how a survey is conducted and follow-up timeframes for when they get their information, when they would get a resurvey, how they can challenge the survey. When we're looking at a substantially more increased frequency of surveys, we think those are reasonable things for the department to implement through survey process reforms. We also are unclear about how surveyors are being trained. If we're going to go from 4 surveyors to 30 surveyors, we want to know that the people are being hired and trained properly. We have surveyors right now that go out into housing with services buildings that do not understand tenant rights. They do not understand fair housing law. They're telling home care providers, you need to make sure someone takes that rug away from that person's apartment. You need to tell them that you cannot lock their door, things that are in violation of fair housing laws. And it's not an intention of the surveyors. I just don't think they understand the complexity of people's rights to live in their own homes and make their own decisions, even if the decisions are bad.
Mr. Beardsley, we are running really tight on time, and we want to go through SHIP because we have a couple testifiers that came a long way to come here, and we have session at 11. So you've made
two more minutes.
Point. We don't have two more
okay.
minutes. So if you can wrap up in 15
sure.
seconds.
So, again, I think on the survey process reform, we have provided the department with language that we think would be acceptable for our members, and we're continuing to debate that, and we hope that that will be supported. And the last issue is simply medication management where people leave home unexpected. And, again, I think we're working with the department on that issue also.
Thank you. I appreciate it. With that, I'll, Senator Kiffmeyer, and while you have your question, can we have Mr. Kevin Goodnow, I believe, is here to testify. Can you please come to the table? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair, he spoke on my
behalf. Okay, perfect. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there is no lack of willingness that we are hearing here. I think we are hearing that there are issues with the process, that they want input that's reasonable. I don't think they're disagreeing. I think it's a matter of timing, how fast, how rapidly, how harshly, or heavy-handed if we're not disagreeing with the goal, nor are our providers. I think we need to recognize that. I certainly hope that the department will be I'd like to hear more about some of these finances and some of these justifications for them that seem to go quite far beyond maybe some of the justifications. But I want to just make it really clear that I hear that people are seeing a need for this, willing to support it, and the request they're making as participating in that is reasonable, and I think hopefully we will see some better language before we get finished with this process.
Thank you,
thank
Senator
you, Madam
Chair.
Chair.
Mr. Greenman, can you please come forward so we can tackle SHIP, unless anybody else wants to testify, but we do want to take a couple of testifiers from SHIP before 11. We can come back to this
you.
Area if need be.
Madam Chair, I think our SHIP proposal has been pretty well explained already.
Sure.
We'd be happy just to give our time to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. With that, Tom Mason, who is president of Alliance for Healthier Minnesota, and I believe we have Tyler Winkleman, and we'll see how much time we have. But we'll start with Tom because he cannot be here later tonight. Mr. Mason, please state your name for the record and
Thanks.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Tom, and members of the committee, my name is Tom Mason. I am the president of the Alliance for a Healthier Minnesota, and I can very briefly talk about I am here. The Alliance is an organization that was founded by employers to emphasize the business case for wellness and the advantages of taking advantage of improving healthy behavior in employers or in employees as a way to create a better culture and to improve the bottom line. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 1034 to tell you why the statewide health improvement program is so important to what we're doing. Since SHIP began, we've seen a dramatic number of employers who have discovered worksite wellness as a defense against ever-rising costs of employee-related health care. This is particularly true among small employers. Large businesses can fight these things because they have large HR departments, but small businesses don't have that luxury. In fact, small businesses, many 100 or below, don't even have HR departments. They don't have the capability of understanding how to implement a wellness program to conceive or implement or rate the ROI of how it's done. SHIP does that. SHIP can help them. The network of SHIP grantees throughout the state become that sort of connective tissue in communities that helps insurers and employers and providers and everybody who cares about wellness into a coalition that would not exist on its own. Small employers in particular really want to get into this game. We at the Alliance for Healthier Minnesota conducted a half dozen polls last year through funding from the CDC. We did a nationwide poll and five polls in states around the country, including Minnesota. And we came up with three, I think, relevant conclusions. I won't bore you with it. I've given you've seen some summary of it in a document. But three things. that really argue for the worksite wellness capabilities of SHIP. One is 81% of employers of all sizes in Minnesota understand the business case for wellness. They understand that wellness is a part of the way that they can curb worksite wellness. Second is that 70% of those say that they need community collaboration to find the resources to do that. That's a very important fact. And third, and this was surprising since these are business employees primarily, they're looking for government to play the role of connector the convener within these collaborations. 78% in the poll in Minnesota said that state and local governments should play a role at or above their current levels of involvement. Remembering too, these are not typical advocates of public health programs. They're primarily businesses. It's a very interesting response. The good news for all of this is the state appears ready to fill that need. SHIP was created, as you know, 4 years ago, as part of a bipartisan solution. Part of its mission is to help employers collaborate on wellness initiatives in their state. We think that SHIP has proven itself to be a wise and useful market-based funding to a solution to help employers reach worksite or health reform through worksite wellness. I urge you to consider funding the SHIP for the duration of the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. If members have questions, and as we wait for those questions, is Mr. Tyler Winkleman here as well to testify? Do members have questions for Mr. Mason? Mr. Winkleman, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. My name is Dr. Tyler Winkleman, and I don't think I have any relation to our previous speaker. I am testifying today in support of Senate File 1034 to encourage you to fully fund the statewide health improvement program. I'm a second-year medical resident at the University of Minnesota in a combined program in internal medicine and pediatrics. I'm also a policy on the policy committee for the Twin Cities Medical Society, and I'm a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics and sit on the state's policy committee. I've lived in Minnesota for the past 10 years and have seen the state's incredible commitment to healthcare firsthand, both as a student and as a physician. I believe it's no coincidence that Minneapolis was recently ranked the number one healthiest city in America by Forbes magazine, but rather a reflection of innovative investments like the statewide Health Improvement Act program. Earlier this year, an Institute of Medicine report was released titled Shorter Lives, Poorer Health. And in this report, the panel compares health outcomes in the United States to 16 similar peer countries. What they found was truly shocking. As one would expect, those with lower socioeconomic status fared worst. But even white insured individuals with healthy behaviors had poorer health outcomes than similar individuals in other countries. Health disparities existed across all socioeconomic levels, all while costing nearly twice the amount per patient than any other country in the world. Reasons for such pervasive disparities are no doubt numerous, and data addressing these issues are scarce. Yet, the public health literature does offer some guidance in creating incentives for healthy lifestyles, safe environments, and nutritious foods that begin to address this American propensity for poor health. Essentially, SHIP translates this public health literature into real-world solutions that tackle issues like obesity, smoking, heart disease, and even safety. SHIP initiatives positively impact long-term health outcomes and are amazingly inexpensive when compared to the cost of treating disease once it occurs. Yet, unfortunately, it's not uncommon for me to see a morbidly obese teen in clinic who already has diabetes, high blood pressure, and fatty liver disease. I feel oftentimes helpless because no matter how much doctoring I do, I know that it won't change my patients' access to healthy food, safe routes to school, or ability to pay for a gym membership. This is why SHIP funding is essential to improving the health of our state and why it can't be left to the biannual budget cycle. My patients and your constituents deserve to know that we are willing to invest in their future and their children's future through a stable funding source committed to improving the health of all Minnesotans statewide. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Winkleman. Do any members have any questions? Senator Claussen?
Madam Chair, thank you. In my past life, I wrote SHIP grants for a school district. So I'm well familiar with them, and they certainly are of value. But I know that there were districts that opted out simply because we can't take on one more thing. And the administration of the SHIP grant that went along with that. And I'd really encourage you to try to streamline the process a little bit. I know the funds generally flow through county and then to school districts in the past. And streamlining the process, streamlining some of the requirements, reporting requirements, would really be helpful. Because like I said, big suburban school districts have said, we just can't take this on. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in regards to, we're well aware of these things. My frustration is the more we talk about obesity, it seems like you just get more obesity. And we've made a lot of work and a lot of efforts. I'm looking for some results along the way that we can actually see some measurable things instead of constantly doing this, spending money, having programs, having regulations, having bureaucracy. And yet all I keep hearing is the rate of poverty is increasing, the rate of obesity is increasing, and it's just going more and more and more. After a while, you just want to say, maybe if we didn't do this, it might be helpful. Maybe, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be generating the kind of results. The other thing that I hear from my district is they'll do some of these SHIP things, but like on the safe routes to schools, you cannot use the SHIP money to actually do anything about what you have found, such as ways to increase leaving the kids off and having a safe route from the bus, then instead of dropping them at the door, to do that, but they can't use any of their SHIP money for that. It has to be only used for talking about it. And some of these things I've seen, maybe they'll get better at choosing their projects, but it's a sustainable issue. You know, what do you do that's sustainable? And secondly, what do you get for results? Because I think after you spend a lot of money, you should have something to show for it other than the jobs created by those who are doing the work.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Benson and...
Madam Chair, are we going to continue this conversation tonight?
I believe we will. We just had two testifiers that one of them could not be here in the afternoon, so I would suggest we'll go into recess if Senator Lowry is okay with that, and we'll go to session, and we'll be back here at 6 o'clock, room 123.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen?
Can we leave our stuff? Or do we have to pack it up?
I think we need to pack up.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, we'll be in recess.